This is an ABC podcast.
As New South Wales gears up for a state election, one of the Labor opposition's key promises is a statewide ban on phones in schools. I'm sure teenagers from Narrabri and Newcastle are horrified at the idea, but it would see New South Wales come into line with most other states, and it's usually very popular with parents. The evidence, though, is not conclusive on how mobiles affect learning. We'll explore the nuances of tech in classrooms today on Life Matters from Wurundjeri Country. Are smartphones damaging to learning and well-being in schools? Or are there worse consequences to not learning how to manage phone use when kids will need to use them in all other areas of their lives beyond school? If you're in a state that already has a phone ban, have you noticed any difference in your child's learning or well-being? Dr. Joanne Orlando is a digital well-being expert and a senior lecturer in early childhood education at Western Sydney University. Joanne, great to have you back on the program.
Hi.
And Dr. Danielle Einstein is with us too. She's a clinical psychologist researching device use and mental health in young people. She's an adjunct fellow in the Department of Psychology at Macquarie University. Danielle, welcome to you.
Good morning.
Danielle, I'll start with you if I may. What's your response to this Australia-wide trend to ban phones in schools? It's happened in most states and territories now.
I think it's wonderful, Hilary. I'm really supportive of it. And there are some really good reasons and studies that show that it's going to be helpful.
And is your support for it mainly about its effect on learning or well-being or a bit of both?
It has an effect on our attention. So one of the really interesting studies is one in which, and people have probably heard about this study already, but it was called the Brain Drain Study, and it showed that if you have your phone on a desk, even if it's silent and upside down, compared to if it's either on your person or in a bag, again, silent, versus being in another room, in each condition, your attention is actually taken up more by the phone being near you than it is if it's another room. And that's even more the case for students who say that they're really dependent on their phones.
All right. So the impact on attention is borne out by the research. Joanne Orlando, what are your thoughts on this trend towards taking phones out of classrooms?
Yeah, look, it's a really popular trend. And just going on what Danielle said, absolutely. You know, we don't want phones on our desk when we're at school learning or when we're at work because it is distracting. But I think there's a bigger issue around this. And that is, you know, we live in the digital age and schools are set up to prepare our young people to live well and work well and learn well in the era in which they're growing up in. So technology is such a massive, massive part of our life, and being able to learn to function well when technology is all around us is a new basic skill that children need. So banning phones in schools, I completely understand the thinking behind it, but it still doesn't answer the necessary need that young people have today.
So are you arguing for a more nuanced view that we need to work with the phones and manage them in different ways?
That's right. Just like our students use laptops for learning and, you know, other kinds of devices for learning. A mobile phone, while it is a slightly different thing in our lives because we're always holding it, it's always in our bag and that kind of thing, but there's so many things we can do with that as well. So being able to use that in a really positive, value-add way as a young person, you can see the advantages of it. And then that should start to chip away at the really distracting kind of passive, repetitive use that we know a lot of young people do, but we know a lot of adults do as well.
Danielle Einstein, there's been quite a lot of research, hasn't there, on as you said, the way they distract us, but also the ways that phones are designed to be distracting. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Oh, yeah. Well, just even notifications are designed to grab our attention. But I think what's more interesting is the fact that when we are thinking about who might be wanting us or what we might need to be doing or who we want to communicate with, our attention goes to the phone. I think one of the things to really think about is the effect on mental health. And we're talking about adolescence. It's an age where social anxiety comes up, worry comes up. And what's really interesting about the phone is how people, whether they're adults, parents, or teenagers, now use their phones to manage their worry and manage their anxiety. And it's not giving us a lot of benefit, actually. I mean, we're actually seeing mental health problems rise. And I think that's partly because instead of learning to manage our anxiety or our stress ourselves in the situation that we're in, we're reaching out to people who care about us, our friends or family, in the moment. And that's actually undermining our own ability to sit with, to see that bad things don't happen, to see that we can form friendships in the playground. And I don't think we've got our head around how the changes in accessing people so quickly and immediately through a phone is actually causing emotional problems.
And we'll have a look at that relationships issue in a moment. But Danielle, can being separated from phones cause anxiety for teens and kids? I just learned about this concept of nomophobia, the anxiety around not having your phone on you. How do we manage that?
Well, I mean, that's a really big problem because that's what then will contribute to other sorts of anxiety and depression. If you're dependent on your phone, then you're in exactly that situation that I just mentioned, where you're leaning on others to such a degree that you're not learning to manage situations yourself. So you're not coming out of school or out of life with the real resilience that we want people to have, where we know that sometimes some things will happen that are unpleasant. But hopefully sometimes these are momentary. Sometimes they're a bit longer, but we have to sort of draw on ourselves. So I think nomophobia is an example of where someone is too heavily reliant on their phone and it's actually feeding their problems with anxiety or other sorts of mental health issues.
So what about the issue of relationships, Dr. Danielle Einstein? What impact can phone use in the playground or in the classroom have on kids' abilities to form relationships?
Well, if I've got this device that I can hide behind, I can either be entertained or I can communicate with people out of school. And if I can use that when I'm feeling a bit uptight, then I'm obviously going to turn to that. And I prefer that than to sort of sit in an uncomfortable situation and maybe look at someone who I'm not sure what they're going to say to me next. I'm not sure if they want to chat to me. And as soon as someone's doing that, of course, it makes the first person who wants to reach out to them or who may be interested in reaching out to them stop. Why would they?
I mean,
anticipating rejection.
Do we have enough research, though, on how phones mediate the quality of people's interactions?
Oh, we do. We've got a lot of research showing that people that are heavily dependent on their phones are actually less happy. So there's a lot to show that phones are playing a really big part in our anxiety and depression. We need to do more studies, obviously, but it's really difficult because who's going to put their hand up and say, okay, I'm going to be without my phone for a long period of time and I need to match that to another person who's going to be with their phone. So we need the whole group to be without their phones. Compared to a whole group with their phones, we need similar situations. There's a whole lot that we require in order to work out how phones affect our mental health and our relationships, which is actually pretty hard to conduct at the moment.
That's a bit disturbing. You can't find any research subjects that are willing to part with their phone for a while. Dr. Joanne Orlando, how would we get around those issues about helping kids put the phones away for a little while in order to have those playground interactions and those social interactions around school if we were looking at using them as useful learning tools or managing our relationships with them?
Yeah, absolutely. And just going on what you were just saying then, I think we need to think of phone use not as a one blanket, you're on your phone, everyone's doing the same thing, because what we do on our phone varies during the day. You know, as adults, we might be working on our phone, checking in with our kids, checking in with the boss, organising something, learning something. You know, there's a whole lot of different kinds of activities we do on our phone. So that's really important to put out there. So what we want to encourage children or young people, everyone in fact, is to be able to use their phone productively. So we want lots and lots of face-to-face interaction. So we want children at lunchtime, you know, talking to each other. But I was saying to someone the other day, just because a group of young people are looking at their phone at lunchtime doesn't necessarily mean it's all bad. You know, part of the way we communicate today is, oh, look at this photo I took, or look at this funny thing I saw online. So it can actually stimulate a lot of conversation as well. So it's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, we don't want them there on there 100% of the time, absolutely not, but it's not necessarily always bad. What we want to encourage young people to do is to be able to use their phone productively when the need arises. So at the simplest form, in a classroom, instead of like taking a whole lot of notes off the whiteboard, you know, like we did 50 years ago as a student, just taking a photo of those notes and being able to use that photo to annotate it, add your own notes to it, cut and paste sections of it. You know, that's an incredibly meaningful use of your phone. It doesn't take us back to learning, you know, in the 1950s. It's learning right now, and it's being able to use a phone in ways that will really help you, you know, in your work life and university life. So it's about teachers being able to have the opportunity for their students to use the phones in creative ways in the class. You know, we don't want the phones on your desk so students can just go onto TikTok whenever they want. You know, that's not the deal. But it's being able to slowly helping them to develop skills to know when to use their phone and when it can have a real impact on their learning and their communication. And that it could be in their bag or in their locker the rest of the time. But schools really need to have this option to be able to work in this way.
I think our listeners are very keen to work out what that might look like in practice. We're speaking with Dr. Joanne Orlando, a digital wellbeing expert and a senior lecturer in early childhood education at Western Sydney University, and Dr. Danielle Einstein, a clinical psychologist researching device use and mental health in young people. She's an adjunct fellow in the Department of Psychology at Macquarie University. A couple of texts I'll just read to you both. Phones in schools set teachers up as police in the classroom. The more teachers become police, the less real learning occurs. Phones decrease focus, disable development of sustained concentration, and are such an extension of the user that intervention becomes a predetermined, failed, sometimes aggressive interpersonal conflict where the phone is not a third party but a part of the student's body identity, which our guests have referred to. Young people, says another from Michael in Narre Warren, have less self-control than the average adult. It's not acceptable to use mobile phones in a business meeting or a training session. I have news for you, Michael from Narre Warren. I have seen these things. Young people don't need to practice ignoring the mobile. They will simply have to do it when necessary as an adult. Julie says it sounds very reasonable to put the phone in another room as a way to manage this device. Danielle Einstein, I had a quick question. Is it true that other devices in the classrooms could be just as distracting? I mean, a lot of schools use tablets or laptops. Kids have smartwatches and things. Are we focusing in on phones when really those devices are unavoidable to an extent?
I think there's some really exciting research that came out about the use of computers in classrooms. It actually showed that, so there was one study in which half of the students in their lectures had computers and half didn't. And it showed that for the half that had computers in their classroom, their comprehension at the end of the lesson was not affected. So everyone had fine comprehension and understanding of the lesson. But when it came to the exam, those who had the devices in their classroom performed worse than those without devices, without the computers in their classroom. And then there was another study that was done in which they asked one student or some students to do an off-task internet activity during the lesson, and then they did a quiz at the end, and they found the students doing the off-task activities obviously performed worse. But really interestingly, in a second experiment, what they found was that the students sitting around the person that was doing the off-task activity also did worse, as opposed to students who were not sitting near someone that was doing an off-task computer activity.
Wow.
Because their attention is just dragged away unintentionally as well.
Wow, it's kind of a passive smoking effect on attention.
Yeah, so it's almost as though, okay, we don't think it's affecting us, but when it comes to actually laying down these memories and being able to pull it out in an exam later, obviously it is having an impact, and we're actually better off without the computers. Now, I know that's not what this is about, but I think it's important to sort of think about whether, you know, are we maybe better off sometimes when we're writing our own notes than taking a photo, Are we, you know, where is our attention? Is it on the computer and what we're getting, or is it on what we're being taught?
Oh, and Julie's texted in again saying also meaningful holding a pen and paper and actually writing. The brain has other neural pathways operating doing that, and then we'll miss that if we don't do more of it. And I know a lot of teachers are focusing on handwriting as well, particularly in the early years. It's a very useful activity. Dr. Joanne Orlando, you mentioned some of the really imaginative and creative ways that young people do use their phones. What are some ways you envisage that they could be useful in a classroom setting as opposed to the kind of school-based laptops or tablets that they do those approved tasks on?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the big question. How do you use a phone? And like we know, students use laptops and tablets in lots of different ways in different subjects. So that's really important to think about, like the kind of skill you're trying to develop in a student and the environment, the learning environment you're creating around it. So one of my jobs is I'm a university lecturer, and I educate my student teachers to be teachers. So the ways that I encourage it in my own students is to think of all the different kinds of skills that you can use and pump into a mobile phone. So one is communication, for example. So recently I had them, you know, go onto campus and interview other students about their childhood. So, and then we came back and we listened to snippets of those recordings, and we kind of generalised the differences people had in their childhood. So that in itself is, we use the recordings, we transcribe them, we analyse them. So that kind of analysis, or using it in a communicative way, is really important. And then of course there's always apps and different simulations, editing photos, all those kinds of things that is very much part of the curriculum now. But I just want to also lead into something about the idea of us being distracted. You know, there was a recent study done of millennials, so that's kind of young adults, young to adults who are up to about their mid-30s, and their everyday workplace. And on average, they use their phone just to hang out, or just using their phone kind of for not work reasons, around 2 hours a day. So their 40-hour work week is really reduced to just 30 hours of work and 10 hours of phone use. So that is a massive issue, isn't it? I think they don't have the skills to be able to manage their phone. So if we're banning phones in schools, then when do our young people actually get to learn to manage it? You know, our technology use has stepped up even more now since COVID. So I think, you know, one of the things that we really need to think about is using the phone creatively and productively in class, but also being able to be in an education program where you're learning and understanding your phone habits and being aware of it, rather than it's just shut down at school during the day. You go home to a very tech-saturated home environment where you're studying for your exams and doing your homework. And then you go into a university or a job where you still just don't have a handle on those phone habits. So that's kind of the argument for not banning your phone as well, that our young people need this kind of education. And unfortunately, it kind of has to go into schools because there's nowhere else for it to be.
That's really interesting,
isn't it? Can I
add
to that?
Yeah, go for it.
So I just want to say that that's interesting, because the millennials that you're talking about, Joanne, actually would not have had phone bans at their schools. So they haven't had an experience of a phone ban. They have actually had the experience of having phones allowed in schools, because at the time that phones came out, we really didn't understand what was going on, and everyone was very excited with the technology. So we haven't, interestingly enough, they haven't had a chance to have a set experience of the day where they don't have access to their phone and they actually find that they're happy and that they can function quite well. So I don't know that, and the other thing is, I think that we can teach about healthy phone use without having a phone in our hand. So we can teach the principles within school and within PDHPE without actually having the phone accessible.
The really interesting text that throw into this context, it says from Jacqueline, the pro phone in the classroom advocate is missing the point. The main activity in the classroom is learning all the things we send them to school to learn. How to interact with their phones is not the main purpose of education. Joanne Orlando, that really speaks to the anxiety that a lot of people feel about young people and technology use, doesn't it? And a lot of people are pointing out that the age of the children in question is key. You know, probably there'll be different needs and rules for very young children as opposed to teenagers, as opposed to millennials. But what do you think is going on for parents that, you know, 80% of Australians support these kinds of bans of phones in schools? We're worried, aren't we, about how we, and particularly our young people, are interacting with and relying on devices?
Oh, we're absolutely worried. I'm doing a really big study for the eSafety Commissioner right now. So I'm spending a lot of time travelling around Australia, interviewing families, all different kinds of families, but families with children who have got mobile phones, you know, who are at school. So I'm getting a lot of really good insight into this. And most parents tell me, like, it's the hardest part of parenting. They feel quite overwhelmed, and one of the big parts of it is they find it really hard to keep up with what their child is doing on all technology, not just their phone, and the continually changing internet landscape. And parents really talk about it in a really stressed way. I think that's really important. So I can completely understand why this is a popular thing. But if parents are finding it really difficult to manage their child's phone use, and often these parents are also the millennials who don't have kind of a handle on their own habits, and then the phones are banned in schools, then I'm not sure where our young people will actually get to learn to be modelled and to be part of an environment where it's acceptable to use technology in a really productive way. It goes away the rest of the time. I'm not saying they're holding their mobile phone in their hand. I'm saying we have a sense of responsibility to young people to teach this. And I also interview a lot of young people as well as part of my research. And they say, you know, why isn't anyone teaching us this? How can you just leave us here to fend for ourselves? So, you know, young people are very much advocates for social change, and they see this as an issue for themselves as well. So I think there's that overwhelm at home. So it's not necessarily happening at home, and then it's banned at school. Then where is it, you know, that they're modelled and shown these kind of good productive habits that they can take into their adult life and into their workplace when they're adults?
Fascinating text. My 12-year-old got a phone on starting high school. Weeks later, he asked to be allowed not to recharge it nor carry it, seemingly agreeing with me that it wasn't necessary. Wow, I think our text line is going to be cheering loudly across Australia at that here on Life Matters. I just want to quickly ask you, Joanne, before we wrap up, does banning phone use at school reduce the frequency of cyberbullying?
Yeah, that's interesting. And just with that text, I have a lot of students or young people that I interview who do start to take control. So it's not as if they're completely, like, you know, unknowing and just go to the extreme. So they do take some responsibility for their phone use. In terms of cyberbullying, you know, that's often one of the issues that's given as part of a phone ban. And we know cyberbullying, or all kinds of bullying, is a massive issue that we want to reduce. But if we look to the research, and why I say we look to the research is that's because where it's really thought through thoroughly, where they've interviewed people, they've observed, they've done surveys, so they actually have a lot of really good evidence. And that's really important, much more so than kind of if you've just chatted to someone. So the evidence shows that the most common form of bullying still, unfortunately, is face-to-face bullying. And cyberbullying takes a second place. Not that that's a good situation, but that's kind of the reality. So in terms of mobile phone bans addressing bullying, well, it's still going to happen in the school playground and in class, and the cyberbullying will still happen kind of after school when cyberbullying normally takes place. So in terms of addressing or, you know, solving the cyberbullying or bullying issue, there's no evidence to show that that's what happens on a large scale.
There actually is one study that's just been released that was done in Spain. Spain's really interesting because they've got what is called a quasi-naturalistic study. There were two regions in Spain that banned phones, whereas the rest of the regions in Spain did not. And what they found was in both of those regions that have banned mobile phones at schools, bullying incidents reduced. only in one region did the maths and science scores actually go up, but in both regions the bullying reduced. So I think that's important to be able to look at.
Well, it sounds as well, though, that there needs to be a lot more research done, and there's a hunger for that research and for support for teachers and for parents as well in this field, as well as for young people. I wish we could talk about this for longer, and I do feel like I say that every day on Life Matters, but this is obviously an issue that's really touched a nerve with our listeners. I really appreciate you both giving us your time and expertise today. Thank you.
Thanks.
Dr. Joanne Orlando is a digital wellbeing expert, senior lecturer in early childhood education at Western Sydney University. And Dr. Danielle Einstein is a clinical psychologist researching device use and mental health in young people. Well, nature's food packaging up next, and some ways that people are replacing plastic with better options. You're on ABC RN.
The World Science Festival Brisbane is back.
Familiar voices from ABCRN are geeking it up all week with brilliant brains from all over the planet. Fran Kelly searches for a net zero future.
Jonathan Webb.
That's me.
Looks at Stone Age medicine.
Paul Barclay asks whether science can save the world. Saturday night, Tegan Taylor.
That's me.
Hosts our science soapbox, Occam's Razor.
If you're in Brisbane, come join the fun and keep listening to ABCRN to hear lots more from the World Science Festival Brisbane. Food for thought.
Corn husks, banana peels, avocado skins. Yes, they are good compost options, but also natural kinds of food packaging, which is refreshing in what can seem like an ocean of plastic in the shops. Alice Zaslavsky is an award-winning author, cook, educator, and friend of Life Matters. And she's very interested in keeping food fresh too, aren't you, Alice?
More than ever.
More than ever. Well, having a kid makes you suddenly go, oh my God, I have to buy so much food. I would really like it to be fresh and full of nutrients.
You're so right. And you need to take it on the go. So it's about being creative and thinking about ways, because the idea of an ocean of single-use plastics, that's where those plastics end up. You know, a third of the litter in our environment is because of all of these single-use items. And there are now alternatives. It's actually a really exciting time to be thinking sustainably. Douglas McMaster, who's the founder and chef at Silo, which is the world's first zero waste restaurant, which was actually inspired by a restaurant right here in Melbourne, Silo, which is where Douglas worked, Joost Bakker and Matt Stone behind it as well. And by the nodding, I know that he and they have been regular visitors to Life Matters and Radio National. But Douglas describes waste as a failure of the imagination.
Because it's a resource, isn't it?
It is, exactly. And there are ways to recycle. You know, that's the real notion of it. Something like wine bottles, and we'll get into hospitality. You know, Douglas turns the glass from those wine bottles into plates and serving ware at his restaurant. It's incredible. I went to visit. He had like a small kind of bucket of waste, and that was from 10 years of whatever it was that they were collecting. Everything else has gone back into the restaurant.
Well, and I've wondered how easy it was for commercial businesses to trial different options, because we're seeing, you know, compostable packaging sometimes, but they're up against really, really cheap single-use plastic options. How do people do it?
Exactly. So what restaurants weigh up then is what their consumers expect. And more increasingly what we're seeing is consumers expect compostable, and not just compostable, home compostable. Because if you buy something like a biopack and you think, oh, that's biodegradable, a lot of these packets are actually only biodegradable in an industrial setting. So just look for the symbol that will specifically indicate home compostable, and then you tear it up, chuck it in your compost. Something like cardboard. If you've got a worm farm, cardboard is very important for those worms. So,
well, and compost too. It's often full of the wet, squishy stuff, isn't it? You need the drier stuff.
You need the drier stuff in order to make your compost useful.
Yep, and not stinky also. Mm. So, I mean, let's start at the basics. When we go to the shops, what are some very easy ways to avoid the plastic packaging when we buy our veg, for example?
The first thing to do is BYO, bring your own packet. So bring your own bags, have them by the front door, have them in your car, have them on your, you know, in your bike basket, just to have that. But if you forget, then a lot of the independent grocers will have boxes. You can ask for a cardboard box to take your stuff home, and then you can bring that box back or utilise it through your compost, whatever you need. And then when you're buying the veg, just remember, not every, you know, three carrots don't need a plastic bag. Just put them in your basket and then put them into your bag to take them home.
And wash them when you get there.
Exactly. And then when it comes to things like corn, buy them in their husks, nature's packaging, instead of buying the ones that have been pre-stripped. Because actually what happens is that once you remove nature's packaging, the food starts to degrade. And that's why they have to put the packaging over it. And there is an argument too for the fact that the reason why this packaging exists is to increase the shelf life, the stability of these items. So from the perspective of food waste, you can see that it's a bit of a balance. But over time, what we're seeing is that people are becoming a lot more kind of conscious and conscientious in the way and the things that they buy.
We should note too that there are some benefits to having things like, you know, the pre-cut fruit and veg on a tray and under plastic wrap. Tell us a bit more about that.
That's a matter of accessibility. So if you have mobility issues or if you're no longer able to cut the fruit and vegetables up yourself, certainly buying them in a pre-cut packaged setting is very understandable. But what we're seeing from even from the majors is that they will cut the fruit and the vegetables up for you on site, and you can bring your own reusable container and put it into that. And
wow.
The same goes. So for your butcher, your fishmonger, when you're buying your fresh produce, bring your own containers and get them to tear that off on the scales.
Tear, T-A-R-E.
Yep. Then pop the produce inside. And the great thing about that is when you get it home on the other end, you don't need to sort of reset it. You just put it straight into the fridge.
Well, and some of us put it straight into the fridge in the plastic bags it comes in. Are you saying it should go in a container?
It should go in a container because the plastic will actually make your meat and your fish sweat. It doesn't have a circulation of air, so the shelf life on it is actually diminished.
It's interesting because I feel like a lot of people, not just you and I, Alice, are very, very keen to reduce the ocean of plastic. But how much of that packaging happens behind the scenes before we rock up with our, you know, hemp bags and cardboard boxes?
That's it, Hilary. So if we're thinking about the food chain, there are a lot of links on that chain before they get to the consumer. But we're seeing innovations there as well. There's actually a Victorian business that's created a shrink wrap that is starch-based. So it's a compostable shrink wrap. And they've just started doing it for pallets. So
that's right, because they put giant wrappings around all the pallet stacks, don't they?
And where does that go? Where does that go? Exactly. So it's really exciting, as I said, that there are these innovations. So what we can do as consumers is agitate and just be conscious and conscientious and ask, are you using compostable shrink wrap? Are you using biodegradable vac packs, which are accessible as well? All of that is moving industry towards being more responsible.
Well, it's interesting too, isn't it? Because we've been seeing local shopping centres have bulk food shops for decades, ages, but the majors have started putting in little, I think, quite overpriced rows of nuts and things. Are they turning out popular? And are there some tips that you have for using those?
Those bulk food shops, I remember even a decade ago, they were very niche and very hipster. And now you're seeing them at the majors. And the reason why is because people are voting with their dollar and they've demanded for that to be accessible. And the reason for the extra price on top is because it's probably more convenient for you. But if you would like to support a bulk food store, there's probably a local one in your area that you can support as well, if it's available to you. And just remember, bring your own containers, and buying in bulk doesn't necessarily mean that you're reducing waste, because you don't need a kilogram of coriander, you just need a small amount. So bring containers and don't feel like you have to fill them too.
I grew coriander this year, which is very unusual for me, and I harvested the seeds and I was like, I'll never have to buy coriander seeds in my entire life now. It was great. I've been giving them away. Sorry, bulk food shops. We're speaking with Alice Slavsky, who loves all things food and is really interested in how food gets from the paddock to us. And this packaging issue is part of that. There is a bit of a work involved for consumers, though, isn't there, Alice? I mean, we still do have to kind of traipse around to the different shops with the different options with our bags.
There's a little bit of a schlep involved, but either we do the schlep or we leave that schlep for our children and grandchildren. And I know that I'm guilting you into making some better choices, but it's about
no judgment.
It's about behaviour change and actually recognising that if we make these small little ripples within our zones, then it will lead to a tidal wave of change. And we need to, as Bob Brown said in his book Optimism, we need to treat this planet like opening a business. You don't open a cafe expecting it to fail. So why do we say, oh, well, the planet's down the gurgler anyway? Every step that we take can take us towards a sustainable future or further away.
Well, it was really heartening to hear you say, look, you know, there is a hunger among consumers for things like really, truly your home compostable packaging. They want the green options. That's really useful for businesses. What about the kind of post-pandemic disruption where suddenly cafes wouldn't take your reusable cup anymore? My butcher stopped taking my containers. Is that getting back to normal now?
It is starting to level out, and that is so true. You know, it did feel like we were moving a really exciting way forward in the sustainability stakes, and then the pandemic hit, and even reusable coffee cups weren't accessible anymore. But we're seeing cafes even take it to the next level. So rather than just taking your reusable cups, they don't have takeaway cups at all. They might have some mugs and you need to bring it back if you work in the local area, or they just will say, sorry, we don't have it, you know, bring it next time.
Wow, I love that. It's kind of really old school, isn't it?
It is. It's old school.
It's community based.
It is. And I think that unfortunately what's happened is that things have become too convenient for us. And yes, it is inconvenient to lug around a keep cup or to maybe bring back a mug. But actually, if we change the behaviour over time, it will just become second nature again.
Well, and that radical idea that you might actually kind of stand at the bar and drink your coffee there.
Yes. And as the Italians say, if you don't have time for a coffee, you need to rethink your priorities.
Ah, the Italians. What an excellent approach to food and coffee and life. Mm. Well, Alice, you recently went to a zero waste picnic with hundreds of people. How did that go? Was there actually bins at the end that were empty?
It was like it had never happened, Hillary. It was a zero waste picnic. Everybody brought their own food. There was catered food on site, but even that was brought in reusable containers. So again, you can imagine that there was some work that had to be done there. But on the other end, it was at the Botanic Gardens, and the gardens were empty of people and of waste. And that is very unusual, particularly for an event with over 1,000 people visiting. And yes, they were engaged, conscientious people that are sustainability focused, but I think we all can be, and we are becoming that way.
Yeah, well, I imagine that's really good, because now I'm not the only person coming to a picnic with a container to take compost away.
Yes.
I was quite excited by that. Though I did read somewhere recently that someone was saying, you can take deviled eggs to a picnic, you just stick them in little individual egg carton things. I was like, that is beyond me. Alice, thank you so much for coming in and showering us with optimism again. It's lovely to see you.
My work here is done, Hilary. Cheerio.
Alice Zaslavsky, who's a food writer, an educator, a cook, and you can find her books, beautifully, beautifully put together books, focus on vegetables in the main, in the bookshops. Food for Thought is this chat that we have regularly with Alice. Well, croissants, baguettes, vin rouge. Our next guest had a few more words than that, thankfully, and a very varied experience when they up stumps to sample French life for a year. That's next on Life Matters. Don't you often find that the reality of things that you've planned, especially with kids, can be much more chaotic than you thought? And now imagine that applying not to a simple trip to the shops or even interstate, but packing everyone up and moving to France. Writer Rachel Mogan McIntosh and her husband Keith did this with their three children. Let's find out how that calm, picturesque French village of their dreams panned out. Rachel, Keith, welcome to Life Matters.
Hi, Hilary. Thanks for having us.
Great to have you both here. Rachel's written a book called Pardon My French. And Rachel, this is something I guess a lot of us dream of sometimes in our downtime. What was happening in your life at the time that made this seem like a feasible idea?
Well, it always kind of hovered in Keith and my sensibility as something we would love to do, because Keith had spent a year in France as a child, and so we knew, you know, that it was a thing that we sort of could do. But we never really put a timeline on it until we were coming out of those early childhood baby breastfeeding, you know, pumpkin everywhere sort of years, and had all three kids at school. And, you know, our littlest, she called Mabel in the book, was starting kindy. And so we were like, I think it's time we take this big leap when we're moving into this new phase.
Yeah, we've got a window. So Keith, you had a little bit of French experience. Why did you choose the particular town that you landed on?
In some year. So when I was in my 20s, I went travelling, backpacking around France, and my sister also happened to be an au pair girl there in the south of France. And she was in this place, Sommières, and I visited there and just loved and love the south of France. Well, so 20, 30 years later, well, sorry, go on.
No, go on.
Yeah. So 20 or 30 years later, when we decided let's pick up sticks and move over to France, all I had in mind, we did, was that somewhere in the south of France, like anywhere east of Toulouse and west of the Alps. And so we thought we'd just rock up to France, drive down and find a good place.
And I'm sure that worked out exactly how you thought it would.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but in fact, the visa meant that we had to book a place in advance, a long-term rental for a year. And so that led us looking online.
There wasn't much
going for a year at the time. We wanted it in somewhere that wasn't too small and wasn't too big. And so it just happened that Rach stumbled across this picture of a bath in a bedroom, and she fell in love with it.
that was the key factor. It's got a bath in the bedroom. We're moving to France.
Exactly.
So, Rachel,
okay. Oh, it just happened to be in the exact same town that my sister had been living in, and we knew that it was perfect for us.
Well, yeah, it must have started to feel a bit fated, but the plans were put in place. Keith would work, and Rachel, you would manage the house and write, and you know, you've bribed the kids with, promised the kids a Disneyland Paris visit on the way, and you move from Wollongong and you land in the village.
Yep.
What are the first impressions?
It was just kind of mind-blowing, I guess, really. We live in this little town on the south coast of New South Wales. We sort of live in the bush with the beach down the bottom of the hill and this little kind of raggedy wooden shack. We've got a composting dunny and tank water, you know, this kind of stuff. There's kookaburras and brown snakes and ticks, and we landed in this medieval village that was just this stone fairy tale cobblestone street land, and behind our house was a 12th century tower, and just down the bottom of, you know, that we could see from our balcony is this Roman bridge that was ordered by Tiberius in the first century AD. It was just a complete different world that we landed in.
And it's, you're right too, that, you know, there were terrible things and wonderful things beyond the picturesque kind of picture postcard aspect of it when you started to try and integrate yourselves into the life there. Rachel, tell me about trying to shift the kids into a new school. How did that compare to the average Australian starting school experience?
Oh, look, it was so different. I sometimes think about it like the idea of how you think you're going to parent when you're pregnant, for example, and you're reading books and thinking about how it's all going to play out. And then the reality sort of hits you like a truck, and it's nothing you could have been prepared for. It was a little bit like that. We had these very romantic ideas about what it meant for the kids to be doing immersion learning, which is this idea that they land basically without any language, and that by being immersed in this completely different cultural experience, that then they would learn the French, and then they would, it would just be some sort of linear progression of getting easier and easier from there. And it just never worked out like that. It was really difficult, which was part of the great blessing of it as well, the challenge and the difficulty, but it never really got easy for the kids to manage the nuttiness of French school. Some of the specific sort of differences were more like here in our little town in Caldo, you know, we're in and out of the little primary school all the time. We're friends with the teachers. The parents have a lot to do with the running of the school. Whereas in Somier, where we were, the school gates are locked. Behind those school gates, the teachers and the students run their own show, and the parents are not allowed in. The idea that you could go up to a teacher or the principal and say, I want to have a word with you about, you know, your teacher being mean to my child or something, is laughable. They would, you know, throw their cigarettes at you. It would never play. It would never play. There's a completely different aspect of where the parents, you know, are expected to stay in their lane.
Mm. Well, in Keith, the practicalities of the day too, the two-hour lunch break in the middle of the day. How did you guys manage that as a family, and how did the kids cope?
Yeah, the two-hour lunch break was a big thing for us, because it was much too long for the kids to stay at school for that, to survive in the playground, to sit down for the three-course meal that all the rest of the kids were doing. So that meant that we walked to the school gates every morning to drop them off, and every lunchtime to pick them up, and then back again after the two-hour lunch, after we'd sort of put them back together and coddled them and, you know, picked up their moods at lunchtime. and then we'd pick them up again at the end of the day. So for Rach and I, you know, it broke up the day a lot, but it was great for us. You know, it got us out. But for me in particular, because I was working from home in, you know, speaking in English, so I got to stand at the school gates, you know, often and speak to the other parents and get to know them.
Yeah, those little interactions sound like the key, don't they? And it sounds like, I mean, it did get better, didn't it, Keith? You did make friends and feel welcomed after a certain point.
Yeah, we did. We actually felt welcomed almost straight away. The kids adopted our kids very quickly. They were very dramatic and romantic and different about it, but they you know, came and introduced themselves. And even on the first weekend, our littlest one had a play date at a friend's house. So that was fabulous for the kids, and the parents were the same. They, they were interested. They were very curious to know what was this Australian family doing in France? What possible reason did we have to move to their little town in the south?
Mm. And I understand, Rachel, that there were lovely playdates, but also there was the playdate from hell. Tell us a bit about that.
Oh, God, yeah. This is a traumatic memory for me. So this was like these kids in France, they were so wonderful, gorgeous, gorgeous, just so funny and sweet and kind, but they were so dramatic and nuts. They were really a lot to handle. And my French was always terrible. So we had this play date one day where there were a couple of extra kids at the house with these two little boys that became like my bonus sons. They used to spend a lot of time at our house, little nine-year-old boys. And there was this one day where the sort of the lord of the chateau had come over to have tea with us, sort of dropped in. And so Keith and I were trying to have like a very genteel afternoon tea down in the bottom room with this man while the five kids just were running up and down the stairs. One of them started setting off like fireworks in the fireworks in the bedroom. Another one like smashed a big jar in the kitchen, and then there were tears and screaming, and it was just the most exhausting play date of my life, I think.
Yes. Well, and I understand, Rachel, that your kind of language struggles came to the fore at various points in some of those interactions as well. What were some of the most traumatic ones, if I can dig those up?
Oh, it was a constant matter of just the only way I could really make my way in Insomniere and just operate running out of the house and running three kids and all that stuff was just to make a fool of myself constantly. There was a lot of mime. There was a lot of, just body language trying to give context to my terrible French. I had to come to terms always with being a real moron, which I think was good for me. It was character building. But probably the most embarrassing faux pas in my French was when I was told months down the track, I was told that this phrase, je suis excité, which was one of my catchphrases that I used all the time, trying to be enthusiastic and friendly. I'm so excited about the shopping or your new outfit or whatever it was. Eventually somebody told me that what I was saying was, I'm so horny. And I'd used it so many times. And so that was kind of horrifying.
Yeah, you've just got to let a lot of stuff go, don't you, about your ego when you're learning a new language?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
We're speaking with Rachel Mogan McIntosh, who's a writer. Her new book's called Pardon My French, and she and her husband Keith McIntosh, who's here with us too, spent a year in France with their three kids, and there were some hilarious ups and downs, some really family bonding times, and a lot of discovery, self-discovery and discovery about themselves as a family that happened along the way. Rachel, we've heard that kind of, you know, French children don't throw food. There's different expectations of French kids. They learn to be adults soon. How did you see cultural differences, if they were that pronounced, playing out when you were there when it came to relationships between parents and children, for example?
Yeah, it's very striking, actually. It really is true, a lot of that stuff. And even when I was sort of trying to take into account the fact that this little town of Sommières is not necessarily reflective of all of France and the way that we live in this little Bobo, you know, kind of semi-hippie little enclave on the south coast isn't also reflective of Australia. Even so, there were these quite striking differences with French children. They have like a a real sophistication about them, that you would go over to somebody's house, and I remember seeing a 10-year-old sort of sniff the cork of the wine bottle. They would take your coat and give you the triple kiss bis, you know, to say hello. And there was a strong kind of cultural understanding that at an adult gathering of any kind, and children were always around for parties and things, that children were expected to kind of handle their boredom or look after themselves in that way. So where in Australia it would be really normal for kids to come up and be like, "Mom, I'm bored, I'm hungry. How much longer do you have to stay here?" Like, that would never happen in Insomnia. That the child would just get, they would get their ear, you know, pulled. That would be met with a lot of scolding, because the expectation is that you would behave yourself in that setting.
Wow, I'm sorry, Francois, but you have to saute your own snails.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly, yeah. So they are sometimes, like, very mature in that way. And then conversely, there wasn't this sense that we often have with children in Australia of these conversations that we have with children around bullying and around emotions and other people's feelings and empathy and those sorts of things. There's an emotional intelligence that is sort of inculcated in children in Australia, I think, that I didn't necessarily see there. So there would be like casual cruelty, the way kids sort of operated in the world, that was striking to me as well.
What are some of the things that you grew to love about it, Rachel, and really miss?
Oh, so much. And I think I learned so much that I took home with me. The reality of our year there was that it was a lot harder than we would have expected it to be in so many ways. But I would have never dreamed that we would be embraced and loved and cared for by the people in the town in the way that we were. So, you know, immediately at the school and in the village and at the language school that I went to, you know, people from every corner would drop us off, you know, hand me down clothes, and they were always just helping us to kind of settle in and assimilate. And the kindness that we were met with over that year was really deeply moving and just absolutely beautiful.
Mm, it just sounds like a very nuanced and wonderful experience for the whole family. Rachel, Keith, thank you both so much for joining us on Life Matters today to help tell us a little bit about it.
Thank you, Hillary.
Rachel Mogan McIntosh and Keith McIntosh. They moved to France for a year with the three kids. It was quite different from some of the ways they thought it would pan out, but it's a really fascinating read and very funny too. The book's called Pardon My French. Now, we talked before about plastic packaging and things like that. One text on that: thanks for all the tips and info. Tragically, our individual efforts to reduce plastic use don't compare with the miles of plastic pallet wrap used in warehousing all over the world at all times. It goes on, it gets slashed off and chucked. It was heartening to hear Alice say that there are some alternatives being trialled made of, you know, compostable and biodegradable substances. But yes, it is a huge problem. Ella from Ballarat texted in on the idea of going to live overseas. Mum took my sister, who was 10 at the time, and me, who was 13, to live in central China for a year. And we went to a Chinese school. It was extremely different. Ella, send us an email. Love to hear more about that. Life Matters at abc.net.au. And earlier, our discussion about mobile phones in schools and whether they should or shouldn't be banned and how they should or shouldn't be managed sparked a lot of discussion. Charlie said, "I'm afraid I strenuously disagree with the doctor who's not in favour of the ban. I taught wellness classes with 14 to 15-year-old girls who literally almost hyperventilated when they had to put their phones in their bags. The addiction was palpable. The greatest learning they could have is not to have their phones in the classroom." And other people strenuously agreeing with Charlie as well. Banning phones could equate to promoting abstinence, says another text, as the only form of sex education. Teaching self-regulation strategies relating to phone use is critical. Lots to talk about there still. Next time on Life Matters, some of us might think a sex ed lesson should be much like a science lesson. New terms to memorise, anatomically correct pictures to examine, or perhaps like that iconic 70s manual, Where Did I Come From? So many beards. For award-winning sex educator and author Corey Silverberg, it's about much more than that. For them, it's about giving the message that there's no right or wrong way to have a body, and that sex is natural and pleasurable. We'll learn more about Corey's approach on our next episode.
touch with ABCRN is easy. Join the conversation live using the ABC Listen app's call and text features.